We are live. We have espresso macchiato at the ready, and we are joined by Matt Benjamin. Longtime viewers of the channel may recognize Matt. We had a discussion on Plato's Gorgias quite some time ago. Video link will be appearing up top. Also, we've joined Matt for some book club discussions, and this is something along those lines, but we are actually exploring a book that Matt has wrote himself. So we are joined by the author of We Are Icarus. Really great book. I have not finished it yet. Have been enjoying what I have had so far and very intrigued by what will be to come.
So yeah, when I was on the channel before you, I was under the moniker of 60 Second Philosophy. So that might be a touch point for some of you guys. I've actually changed that channel name since I've been doing the author thing, trying to unify the brand. You know, everything is just my face and my name, I guess. But yeah, since over the past 2 years, I've been working on this novel, and I have it right here. Actually, here it is. This is the cover. This the one that will be coming to anyone who purchases it will be for resale. This is a proof copy, so that's why there's this gray band on it. But yeah, it's a dystopian novel, sort of sci-fi-ish, and has some elements of great dystopian books like 1984, Brave New World, and maybe some movies that you may be familiar with, like The Matrix. It's got a virtual world and some bad things happening inside and outside that world.
Well, my favorite part of it has been, which is also coincidentally my favorite part about The Matrix and about so many great dystopian works, is the ways that we can use fiction, we can use story to be able to give these philosophical themes, but in a much more, well, much more of a way we can empathize when it's characters going on. And I've loved the mythological themes you've had here, of course, with the title We Are Icarus. I'm curious, in terms of, obviously that's a clear reference, we have some to other philosophical texts, and I'm wondering what you think is a reason that we see these classic mythological philosophical themes appear so often, even thousands of years after they were first introduced in modern literature and cinema.
I think the first obvious answer is any classic, right? Anything that's kind of stood the test of time has done so for a reason, because it sort of hits a nerve on our human experience. It says something about us that we resonate with, whether it's something good or something bad. So just the fact that these myths have been around for a long time sort of lends them to being, you know, have that power, no matter kind of when it comes from. But I think we can look at myths from different times and different cultures, and you know better than me, but they tend to be everymanish. Like it sort of speaks to me and speaks to you, and it does so because it's rather broad in the scope of what it's trying to say. Like we all have these experiences, whether they're at work or in our families or wherever we are, that sort of, oh, you know, there's that thing that I remember seeing in so-and-so myth. And we can kind of take those, the character's actions, and say, oh, well, maybe I shouldn't be like that person, or maybe I should be like that person, and sort of apply it in those ways.
Yes. I love that idea that there's so much that story can communicate, for whether it's someone who's a bit more of an everyman, whether it's someone who's a bit larger than life, because goodness, we have characters coming from the divine to the mortal to everyone somewhere in between. And there's just so much variety in the characters and settings. But I've especially found in mythologies so many recurring themes, where what I love about myth as story, and it's why this channel's Mythos and Logos. Mythos meaning myth or story, and Logos meaning literally word, but has been used to describe, I like to use the term pattern of reality. And what I love about mythology, so Mythos, Logos, is that we're taking stories and presenting these patterns. I love your use of the myth of Icarus, in that it's one that so many at least if you're in this Western context, you've probably heard before the idea of flying too close to the sun. But there's actually a lot more to it when we go back to the original Greek sources, where Icarus is only one part of this larger cycle. So how familiar are you with the overall context? Because there are a few different characters.
You would think, having written a book with the name, I would have done a whole lot of research, but I really didn't. And that kind of goes back to what you were saying about myth, is like, it had, you know, just a little seed of this image, right? I've got, you know, the guy falling on the front. Like, that image is almost enough to evoke so much, so many thoughts, so many emotions. And of course I knew the basic context. I like all this Greek stuff, so I keep my finger to the pulse of the ancient Greek world if I can. But as far as what happened leading up to, the only exposure I actually had to it was from the novel Circe. Are you familiar with that novel?
It's a retelling of the Odyssey. Is that right?
Yeah, it is sort of. The Odyssey is sort of mixed in there, but it's actually the witch Circe, her story. It's a decent novel. It's not bad, but it tied in a lot of these different stories, which was kind of cool. So I don't know how close she was to the real account.
Right. Well, I'll need to take a look, and I'll be sure to find out. But I definitely love, as you had mentioned, that the myth itself, you can evoke something with just a symbol. And what I love about so many mythic traditions, especially the Greeks, because there is just so much that is still preserved from them, is how interconnected everything here is. So if we go back to the story of Theseus, who's this heroic king of Athens, he is best known for battling and defeating the Minotaur. Theseus, he's a prince at the beginning of Athens, and Minos, which is on Crete, historical kingdom there, is demanding sacrifices of the Athenian youth each year. They're going to be fed to the Minotaur, this bull-man hybrid that lives in the labyrinth underneath the palace in Crete. And so Theseus goes to slay the Minotaur, but he has this problem where it's a labyrinth. When you go in, you're not going to get out, is the entire design. So he actually goes to the father of Icarus, Daedalus. And in terms of the scale from God to everyman, I feel like Daedalus is kind of think of a Batman or an Iron Man, in which it's his craftiness that sets him apart. So Daedalus gives Theseus the golden thread, and it's kind of like a Hansel and Gretel with the breadcrumbs. He ties the thread at the exit, so as he goes in, he can slay the Minotaur and then follow that thread to find his way out. And I love it because it teaches you with the symbol, hey, if you're going into a dark place, remember to have something tying you to the world outside, or else you'll just become lost in that confusing interior darkness. But as Theseus, like most heroes do, succeeds in slaying the monster, frees the princess, all that wonderful stuff, he goes home, has his own story. But Minos, the king, is not very happy. He's not happy with Theseus, but he's not happy with the guy who gave him his out, which is Daedalus. He knows that there's only one person who was around who would have been so crafty. And so he ends up searching. And the way that he searches for Daedalus, he places this challenge where he takes like a nautilus shell, the beautiful like fractal sort of image, and says, I will give a prize to anyone who can put a thread from the outside of this into the inside. A lot of people try to brute force their way through. Does not work, as moving anything so delicate won't. So then Daedalus, he rises to the challenge, and what he does is drills a small hole in the center and ties the thread to an ant, puts the ant in one side and waits for it to come out the other. So he's not going to be the strongest guy. He's not going to be the most dexterous, but he is so clever. This is a case where the cleverness, though, gets him thrown in prison. And Daedalus knows a way out of prison, and that way is through his same craftiness. So he and his son, who's locked up with him, his son being Icarus, Daedalus crafts them each a pair of wings. So really, Iron Man in Vietnam in the comics, or in Afghanistan in the Marvel films, right? He's trapped and he's got to rely on his ingenuity to get himself out. But he warns his son of two things. One of which, of course, with the fall, is not to go too close to the sun. But the second, which most people don't realize as much, is you can't go too close to the ocean either. Because if you fly too high, the sun is hot and it will melt the glue holding the feathers together and you will go falling to the ocean. But if you stay too low, then you're going to end up having the metal pieces rusting and then your wings won't be able to flap and you'll end up crashing into the sea again. So I find it very interesting that maybe it's because we're in a very ambitious cultural period in history. We really focus on that idea of flying too close to the sun, which is, of course, what Icarus does. He is so thrilled to be able to fly. He just takes it, goes wild, and the wings melt. And before he has a chance to bring himself back down, it's too far gone. He crashes into the sea, which to this day is known as the Icarian Sea, whereas Daedalus, who keeps the middle path, ends up making it home to live another day.
Yeah, that's a very Greek thing. When you said that, I was reminded of Aristotle and the Golden Mean, where he takes two basically vices, say, you know, brashness and cowardice, I guess. And he says right in the middle of those is how you should act, and that's courage. And he does that with a whole bunch of stuff in the Nicomachean Ethics. It seems like a very Greek thing, you know, those who are where temperance is an important virtue. We don't see that so much today as an right. important virtue, but it was to them.
So I definitely see a parallel in to move a bit further east in Buddhism as well. There's a middle path where so the historical Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama Shakyamuni, he originally was the prince sheltered in the palace, was not allowed to view any kind of suffering at all. Legend says that if a leaf was falling from a tree, a servant would pick it up before it hit the ground. And then he goes out and witnesses the suffering in the world. First, he tries to dedicate himself to just an ascetic life like a hermit in the woods, but ends up finding that mean, which is having a community that's intentional. And that's where the Sangha, the Buddhist community, then comes from. So I think it's so interesting that we see these ideas expressed in different cultures in different times, but also through the Greeks. It's so interesting you bring up Aristotle, because it can be hard to date myths, but the mythic cycles and traditions that this belongs to is certainly older than when than Socrates' time. Story communicates in one way, and logic, philosophy communicates in another. But it seems like they're very much getting at the same thing in this case between Aristotle and this myth.
Yeah, I think that's why we'll just use the word literature, fiction, really broadly, is so important, because not everyone's going to be, you know, reading. I'll use the example of like Kant, you know, like it's kind of dry reading. It's not really great for, you know, winding down at the end of a day.
I know, but I've tried.
Yeah. So he had important things to say, you know, a lot of these guys really did. So the cool thing is where you can take big ideas and you can kind of refine them or kind of focus them into a format that's much more accessible, like a novel. And you see that all the time. And I think that's why Plato is my favorite philosopher, because he does both, right? He's got the philosophy, but he's delivering it in this form of fiction. All his dialogues are fictional. It likely never really happened. Mm-hmm. And it's just something that good books can do really well and sort of communicate big ideas to everyone, you know, to who they're really applicable for.
So what made you choose to communicate your big ideas through the form of this novel rather than through a dissertation or a set of formulas.
I thought the academic life was going to be life for me. When I went to college, I studied humanities and great books, and then I did a grad program. And my goal was to continue on PhD, do academics, teach at a college, write books. And, you know, life circumstances were one of the main reasons that that didn't happen. But another thing, somewhere along the lines of me studying, I realized that you can actually teach more through fiction than you can through nonfiction. Number one, your ideas are probably going to be disseminated a little further. Like we said, a lot more people are reading novels than they are philosophical treatises. But otherwise, you can actually kind of bypass a certain element of the human psyche. You know, like if you're writing straight academic writing, presenting something to someone's intellect. But if you're writing a novel, you're really presenting something to something a little deeper, whether it be their emotions or something a little more fundamental. And so that's why it's dangerous as well, because, you know, true facts get in there, but so will false ideas. And so I think I first learned that reading C.S. Lewis. Mm. He was a really smart guy.
Master of his craft.
As far as it goes, he wrote a lot of nonfiction that we don't really see much anymore about, you know, the medieval world and stuff. That was his thing. He was a medieval scholar. And the interesting thing is what he kind of stands out for is his fiction. And it's just full of really big ideas that have survived because of the format that they were in.
I was in a campus group. We had been reading the Screwtape Letters. You can read a theological text, and there can be so much depth in there, and it's incredible, but also very hard to relate to on that human level. If you're focusing on this, therefore this begets this, and this is consubstantial with this, by the way, it gets so difficult and easy to get lost in the weeds, almost, as opposed to taking an idea and putting it into your life. I think that's something that C.S. Lewis is able to communicate so well. The how does a life lived according to principles look? Mm-hmm. I think Tolkien is so fantastic as well. I mean, great love for the Inklings. Chesterton, it's so great.
Have you read any Charles Taylor by any chance?
I have not.
Yeah, he was an Inkling. He was one of the one of the minor league Inklings as far as his production, but he wrote these really interesting books. One of them was called The Place of the Lion, and it was basically what would happen if Platonic forms broke into our reality. And it's definitely dense-er for fiction, but it's definitely worth a read if you had a chance.
I definitely will. So while we're on...
Did I say Charles Taylor? I meant to say Charles Williams. I said Charles Taylor. Charles Taylor wrote Secular Age. I don't know if you've heard of that book, but separate thing.
Is that much more recent?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
10, 15 years ago.
Okay. That yeah. I've heard of.
Yeah.
So with the ways that storytelling can communicate these through like these high concepts, I mean, Platonic forms coming into the world sounds so cool. The idea of, right, to bring it to Lewis, the letters from between the devil and one of his apprentices. So yeah. Interesting. Can you tell us a little bit about the high concepts of the world in We Are Icarus? Because there's a lot we've kind of touched upon, and I feel like there's a lot more that in the limited amount I've read hasn't quite been revealed yet. But tell us a little bit about your world and why you chose to build the world the way you do.
Sure. So excuse me if I just ramble for a little while. One thing you'll learn if you write a book is that it's easier to write about a book, to write a book, than it is to talk about it. It's a completely different skill, but I have to learn. So here's my practice. What this book was sort of born out of a trip I went down through the classic dystopian novels. And actually we were in a discussion about Brave New World, I think.
Yes.
And that was one of the first ones that I'd read. And what I learned about the dystopian novels there was that they're so useful, not just that kind of like explaining how everything's going to go wrong. That's kind of what I thought. It was like, okay, here's all the bad stuff that's going to happen. And we can feel bad about it, but really sort of about how humans tend to act and the things that we normally do that will ultimately lead to, you know, unfortunate ends, unless we do the things that sort of resolve those problems or that counter those problems. Mm. And so as I looked at our world and the world that's increasingly drawn to technological escapes, I took that and I sort of just exaggerated it. What's the worst that we could get, the most intertwined with technology that we could possibly get? And so it's sort of like this idea that we see in the Matrix, right? It's this virtual world that looks exactly like the regular world, that you couldn't tell the difference. And so then the question is, if we're in this world that's really nice, that I can't get hurt, I can't be sick, good things happen to me, why would I ever want to be in the other world? And I think we're seeing a lot of that now with people on their phones and on computers and stuff. Like, why would I want to not be staring at my phone? Why would I not want to be getting these instant dopamine hits every second? Like, what's the reason not to do that? And I think if anyone stops and thinks about it for long enough, they'll see the negative implications of that lifestyle, and they'll see that it does hurt you. And it takes some thought, it takes some intentionality. But when I was trying to think of sort of the solutions, I went back to another ancient text. I went back to Genesis. And in the book of Genesis, Genesis 1 and 2, as the creation is kind of happening, God says three things about or to mankind in this state of perfection, right? Everyone's doing well. Things are going well. And he says, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. And then later on in chapter 2, he says, it's not good for man to be alone. And if you bring those terms to their essence, it's basically work is good. It's good to work. Productivity is good. Creativity is good. And community is good. Those three things are sort of the baseline for humanity before we get anything moral, before we get any, you know, don't kill your brother, or before we get don't steal, before we get don't commit adultery. All these things are way later. As humans, qua human, we know it's good to work. We know it's good to create, and it's good to be with one another. And so I kind of used that as my framework for the solution. And so the first half of the book is taking those early chapters of Genesis and sort of using that as a framework. The events of the book sort of have that feel, many allusions to those texts. And then the second half of the book is using those ideas of community, creativity, and productivity as a potential solution for getting out of our quagmire of virtual problems.
I think there's something so powerful in that you're choosing positive commandments rather than negative ones. I mean, if you turn to any given page of the Bible, there's going to be a don't do this. Don't do this. By the way, don't do this. Don't eat this. Don't eat this. Don't mix this fabric with this one. Don't do it.
Yeah.
And not to discount, but to get to all of that is after the fallen state. And yet the before you have the be fruitful and multiply, to subdue the earth, and to not be alone. And then later on, I've always thought as well in terms of New Testament, where Christ's commands are love your God with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself.
Right.
Positive do this things rather than negative don't do this things. Mm. And I think it's very easy to... And very hypocritical while we do this, right, in core, while we do this over a virtual chat, to be able to say, oh, it's these kids and their phones. You're looking at them all the time on your TikToks. But there's something more in terms of what should our life look like? Mm-hmm. What can we do rather than what can we look down upon others for doing, or right, look down upon ourselves for doing? that there is much of a prescriptive factor to this too. In the imagery in your novel, I mean, it's so striking to me, my first read, that in core, in the virtual world, everyone is, you know, you're built like a video game fighting game hero, where everyone's in their incredible shape, you look great, and then in the real world, out of the core, you're a huddled, soft, squishy, gray blob. And then there's a character who's an exception to a degree, which, without getting into too much, I find Verity to be a very, very interesting character in terms of her place in that world. I wonder, with questions of how someone could be so different from the trend which is around. I definitely got a bit of a flashback to thinking about Boethius in The Consolation of Philosophy, when he's in a prison, more of a literal one than the self-constructed virtual prisons. But I felt like there were some parallels to the idea of Lady Philosophy, Lady Wisdom, that you've tied in. Am I barking up the right tree here?
Yeah, I think, I'm kind of a sucker for using the names to kind of indicate something about the person. So the term Verity obviously has some element of truth. And so she's going to be saying true things and sort of using whatever means she has at her disposal to get the main character, Icarus, to kind of see the problems that his world is going to cause him. And, you know, like any good protagonist, he doesn't get it at first, but you know, through time and through other means, hope he does, you know, not to spoil it, but that was actually one of the big questions I had as I was writing the book, is like, for someone like that, like, what, and I say someone like that, like, I'm like that sometimes, you know, I haven't been on social media so much in my entire life as I have trying to promote this book. So like, I feel the drain of it, and I feel the just the ease of flipping it on and swiping through some stuff. But for someone who's really just consumed by that world, and what would it take to show them something better? Well, I mean, you can get my answer by reading the book, but I think it's something that we should really think about, how that might work. And part of it is just, you know, things that are true, things that are good, and things that are beautiful.
Yes. And on more the side of how you've been promoting the book, the writing, because you self-published, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So to anyone listening right now who might be inspired, they have an idea of their own, what does a creative process look like on that? Do you have any advice on how to just start getting it out of the mind and onto the paper?
Yeah, I think a couple of things were really helpful for me. When I first started, I've always wanted to write. I mean, since I was a kid, I thought it would be really cool to write a book. And I don't think I really started writing a thing until I was maybe late 20s, 28, something like that. Because, you know, they say that your brain doesn't fully develop until a certain point. I really think that must be true, because the idea of sitting down for an extended period of time for hours and just working on one thing was very difficult for me, but something clicked and I was just able to do it. So as I started writing, I think working on the craft side of things, learning kind of what works and what doesn't, learning the rules so that later you could break them, you know, is really helpful. And realizing that the first thing that you write is typically not going to be very good. Be ready to revise. I know I had to revise a whole lot. And really the first book I wrote, I haven't even done anything with. I wrote a whole book and I don't know what's going to happen with it. But coming into the second one, I learned a lot. And then I guess the other thing would be community. You know, like I said, it's so important, even in a solitary activity like writing, having people that you trust to look over things, having people, like, creating a community that's also skillful at what they do, to say, oh, that doesn't work, that's no good. And even if you like it, you know, it's no good. You know, I just trust them and realize that other people's opinions are significant when you trust them. And then you have to kind of work into that other state of mind when you publish something. And I'm learning that now, is that some people's opinions are more significant than others. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can get really high praise that's not really deserved. And you can also get really harsh criticism that's not deserved. And so sort of being able to moderate your expectations of other people's appreciation of your work is another really important thing to do anytime you put anything out there.
Yeah, I mean, we've both seen our fair share of YouTube comments, and there is so much really great and so much not as great and so much that is just entirely out of left field. But it feels like it's important for you then to surround yourself with the right kinds of people in the right kinds of mindsets that you're using to be able to bounce your ideas off of. What does that look like in terms of between authors? Because I know y'all will sometimes read each other's work a bit, yeah. Or how exactly?
So I've got a network of people that probably like strong two, and then some others that I'll talk to as well. But where, you know, basically I expect to probably read anything that they're going to write, and they're pretty much expecting to read anything that I'm going to write. And these are usually people that I send my work to fairly early on the process. So with the first draft is either done or getting towards done, and sort of getting some big picture feedback. And that's, you know, super helpful to do. But one thing that you have to be careful when you're writing for authors, and I say this as myself when I'm reading other people's work, is that we kind of all know the rules, like, you know, oh, this sentence is written in the passive, it's too pat, you know, it's in the passive form, or, you know, there's too many adverbs here, or you really shouldn't do this sort of grammatical structure because it's sort of not good form to do. And so you have to be able to also shut that off a little bit and be like, okay, like the sentence sounds good, you know, just because the subject is, you know, the verb is passive, doesn't mean that I shouldn't use it all the time, or just because there's an adverb in the dialogue tag doesn't mean that I can't make a good sentence. Mm-hmm. So, you know, writing for authors is a little bit different than writing for readers, because a lot of times readers won't pick up on those things, but those rules do exist for a reason, because if you do them, you know, do it too often, you'll really have something very clunky, difficult to read.
Yeah, it seems very much like there's a lot of like it can be easy, especially when you're an author reading another author's work, to get caught up in the technicals. What about in terms of, like, I mean, you definitely have a very strong thesis in your work. You definitely have something to say. And what is it that you find you'll look for, or you'll want others to see when you're writing, in terms of the meaning or purpose coming across?
I think the big challenge is, like we said earlier, like, you could just write an essay and hand someone an essay and say, okay, this is what I want you to know. But being able to communicate that in something that is also entertaining, you know, that's when I took a literary criticism class, that's, you know, good art seeks to teach and entertain. I think that might be Aristotle as well. Those two elements are so important. You could have something that's really entertaining, maybe like a circus, right? Mm-hmm. And clowns running around juggling, and you're not going to learn anything from that. And I feel like a lot of books out there today, not to disparage them, but like, they're written to entertain. They're written taking all the tropes that people know are very popular and just shoving them into a book and saying, you know, you're going to like this because it's, you know, like the five other books that just recently came out with the same trope. And it's really difficult. I found it's really difficult to find a lot of people who kind of agree with me on that, who agree that there should be some substance to a novel, which maybe,
as opposed to it just being an escape kind of thing.
Yeah. And maybe that's because of, you know, the other forms of entertainment that we kind of consume are more short form, and there's less substance there. But I remember there's this thing called, you get into it when you're doing the self-publishing thing. It's called advanced reader copies. And the idea is that if you go into the right places, right, the right dark holes of the internet, you find all these authors that are trying to shill their copies of their books so that they can get reviews. So there are Facebook groups that are just people saying, read my book, give me a review. They give it to you for free and you're supposed to write a review. And so when I was interested in sort of seeing what else was out there, kind of surveying the landscape, I went on to one of these. And remember, this is a place where people are, I mean, they'll hound you to read their book. If you just, you know, pop your head in there, they're going to send you books left and right. And so I went in there on one of these Facebook groups and I wrote, I'm looking for an advanced reader copy of a book. This is paraphrasing, but of a book that was written for a purpose, that's thoughtfully written and that is trying to teach me something. And I did this in two separate Facebook groups. And I did not get a single response from anyone, from any of the thousands of people trying to shill their book. And it was mind-blowing to me that people are writing these things without any intention of saying anything besides just writing an entertaining story, which, I mean, they probably are entertaining stories, what do I know, but it was kind of like mind-blowing, really.
There's something to it where entertainment and escapism, it can be great and fun. And I don't think it's necessarily mutually exclusive from something meaningful too. To go off on a bit of a tangent, I am a nerd for professional wrestling. And when it's bad, it is absolutely terrible. But when it's good, it is so fantastic. Because you have a baseline of entertainment, which is like, look at how many flips this guy can do. Or let's watch these two big muscle men just punch each other until somebody falls down. And that's fun. Sometimes you just want to, there's one wrestler who says his favorite matches are big meaty men slapping meat, and goodness, it is just muscles crashing into muscles, like ridiculous. But there is some of the absolute best of it is when, instead of just putting on a show of look what I can do or look at my bodybuilding, when people use the format of a ring to be able to tell stories, that you can, through the different ways people interact, the characters do, the different types of moves, the different alliances they'll have with each other, you can get, and I'm not overhyping, genuinely up to like Shakespearean levels at some points in terms of the drama and emotional intensity.
When you said that, it's so funny because I had recently, within the last year or so, I don't know why, like YouTube just kept recommending WWE stuff to me.
They are now the number 10 most subscribed channel on YouTube.
Oh, wow.
You know how if you get like real popular, you get a silver play button?
Yeah.
They got a red diamond play button.
But one of the things that was really like it clicked in my mind, just I don't know why, I was watching this and I was like, these people need to be everything. Like, they need to be in really good shape, right? They need to be huge, but then they also need to be able to do like backflips and stuff. They need to be acrobats, which is not, those two things don't always go together. But then on top of all of that, they need to be able to act. Like, they need sort of skills that are sort of outside of both of those wheelhouses,
right? And so not it's really, just athletics.
Yeah, it's a real interesting combination of skill sets that you need to have to do that. So I can totally see how when people are talented in all those avenues, they can come up with something pretty cool.
I am going to send you a couple of like compilation videos of the guy who's probably my favorite at the moment. My favorite changes every couple of years. But there's this fellow, Sami Zayn, and he is incredible as a storyteller. I'll send you a couple things. But you can be entertained and also have these plot threads that are going on for, I mean, months to years in some cases. And if you can tell a story and have that genuine human emotion. Sami Zayn had this story with the guy Roman Reigns, who's been champion for the last like 3 years. And through their story, he was this outsider who wanted in on this family group that ended up causing him to question his own morals and who he was to his best friend. And it's so much more than just big meaty men slapping meat. Mm-hmm. And it's so fascinating. And I think that a great novel, a great book, a great podcast, a great myth has all of it. Mm-hmm. Like Hercules fighting the Hydra, that's pro wrestling. I mean, what more? Hercules probably looked like freaking The Rock. Plato was a wrestler. So
yeah, Plato, that's his name, broad.
If you imagine these kinds of like Hercules as this Rock or Roman Reigns or like Arnold Schwarzenegger to a degree, though not a wrestler, as an entertainer kind of guy, battling these monsters, there's how much can a human be capable of? And then there's also a, what if you're more than human? You get into things like superheroes there when you're looking at these demigods who have their single weaknesses. But then it's also, right, you're fighting the Hydra. It's an awesome guy slaying a dragon, but it's also saying, well, if you have a problem, and as soon as you cut one head off, three more spring up in place, well, you better start attacking this at its source rather than fighting off the symptoms. Hmm. And in the story of Icarus, you have the craftsman and his child who's the heir to it. But if you're the heir to all of this ingenuity, be careful what you do with it, because if not, you'll come crashing back down to Earth, or you'll never get higher than the Earth anyway, and it will fail you. Yeah. There is just so much in storytelling that is, has been, and continues to be true. And I think that's just something so beautiful. And it's really, really excellent that your work, the ambition to take part in that tradition, definitely shows through. The ambition to show something entertaining that is also a story with a purpose. I mean, those are the kinds of things, and I mean history will tell, right? But those are the kinds of things that these really great stories that we tell for centuries and generations have. I think it's just absolutely fascinating and really awesome to be able to speak with an author who's doing his small part to keep those traditions going and see how they change in our modern day and where they'll go.
Yeah. Thanks so much for talking. I'm glad that we were able to connect on this. When I was first started to promote a couple months ago, I thought this would be the perfect channel to have this conversation. So I'm glad that it happened.
Well, thank you, Matt. You've been an awesome guest. There is a link down here in the video as well as in the description. So fantastic. And when can we get your book?
The book comes out on the 14th of March. It is coming out on ebook, paperback. And if you have Kindle Unlimited, it will be on there as well. So you can read it for free if you subscribe to that platform.
Perfect. Even better. And and for those who want to get in, we can pre-order now and it would be given to us when it's on the official release date
on the 14th. That's right. If you like it, review it. That's important.
Perfect. Absolutely. Well, awesome, Matt, really a pleasure. I do appreciate you, and thank you everyone else for coming by. If you have a story to tell yourself, something with meaning, heck, let us know. Really excited to see what happens in this world that we're in, where we have so many resources that the timeless can find a new place. So that's right. I am so excited for what's to come. Thank you so much, Matt.
See you later.